Welcome. This is William Evans, and you are listening to Shifting Gears. Our guest today is Michael Thompson, a basalt architect and longtime friend of fruit trees. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you, Will.
Are you looking forward to anything special this new year?
Oh, let's see. Yes, I'm looking forward to buying some collard greens at Skip's Farm to Market.
Basalt.
Yes, and turning it into a fine traditional feast.
What are you watching in our local world?
Wow. Primarily, I'm watching the evolution of local economies, having seen so many communities really devastated by global economic and political problems they have no control over. And seeing the history of local economies, local currencies, and things like that is really fascinating to me. And so I'm planning to do a community discussion series in March and April at the Basalt Library to discuss some of these things and see what local communities here are interested in doing.
Well, this is certainly a potentially confusing time for a lot of people. It sounds like you'd like to bring some clarity to that.
I would, yes. And there's some history behind it. And the Roaring Fork Valley here, Rocky Mountain Institute, partnered with Carbondale back in the 80s and early 90s to develop what they called economic renewal for communities. Carbondale was at that time affected by the four lane of the highway, away from their town center. And since then, we had the Carbondale Economic Localization discussion series in the early 2000s. And a lot of things have happened since then as well. We've got all these new young farmers that are leasing land and producing food for the farmers market. We have one of our farmers from Palisades, Skip Doty, started Skip's Farm to Market in downtown Basalt, which is a phenomenal store. So a lot has happened, and I think it's time to bring this new generation into the discussion.
Well, that's exciting because the need hasn't gone away.
Right.
I was impressed with the quality of the documents you sent to me in regard to this anticipated conversation. And I want you to elaborate on the quote you used from Thomas Paine. He said, "We provide them the means to oppress us."
Right. He was talking about the British, who were in control, governing the early American colonies. And the British were not very kind about that. They taxed heavily. Everyone remembers learning about the Boston Tea Party and no taxation without representation. And Thomas Paine was basically in his pamphlet called Common Sense, published in February of 1776, really ignited the move toward the Declaration of Independence. And he basically said many different things in there besides outlining how bad was a government from the King of England on the colonies, but primarily he said, you know, by our acceptance of their rules and by our collaboration with them and by our trade with them, we are complicit and we are basically handing them the tools with which to oppress us. And I thought that really rang a lot of bells for the world today.
Right. And you ask us to examine the pursuit of wealth for the purpose of economic advantage, mm-hmm. and whether that's real wealth.
Right. There's a lot being written now and a lot being discussed now about the way that our Industrial Revolution has evolved to where we are today. And so much of it is extractive. And the global industrial movement has tried to make everything into a mass production scenario, including agriculture. And agriculture isn't suited very well to that. Monoculture doesn't work with nature very well. And so I think it's important for us to realize what's appropriate in what industry in order to create health. Because when we are creating wealth. We're actually extracting nutrition from the soil to create the food we eat. We're extracting oil out of the ground and making fertilizer out of it to create the food that we eat. And none of it is actually improving the health of the soil. It's improving the wealth of some people. Certainly, it's improving their numbers, and since we all accept the value of currency, it gives them a tremendous advantage. Anyone who accumulates a lot of wealth has a lot of numbers in their bank account, if you will, and this is providing an advantage over others. They can buy more, they can control more rules, and et cetera. We all know how that works. But real wealth, as Brooke Levin will tell you, as many of these young farmers will tell you, real wealth is the health of the soil. Casey Pescura at Wild Mountain Seeds, I think he said it best. He said, true freedom lies in the health of the soil beneath our feet. And when I think about what he said, when I think about that, I can't come up with a better answer. Wealth is banking wealth, provides the people who have it great advantage in this world because everything is acquired with money. But if you have healthy soil and healthy water, clean air, good sunshine, good practice, permaculture or biodynamic practice, you can make your soil more and more healthy every year, more and more productive every year instead of less. That's true wealth, in my
view.
Yeah,
I'm looking at the definition of real wealth you used. It complements what you've said already. Real wealth should be considered to be that which provides people and nature with healthy living resources sustainably and indefinitely. Anything less results in degraded resources for which our descendants will have every right to vilify us.
Yes. I think we really need to understand something I heard on the Permaculture podcast. We are the architects of the next 10 generations. So what we do today, they will remember us for. And when we think about it that way, improving the soil, improving the quality of our water and our environment is the best favor that we can do to generations that are down the line from us.
And the pursuit of the wealth of these rectangular certificates of fiat currency allow us to ignore the ecological, economic, and social problems created that have consequences to our local watershed.
And other watersheds. Our money is universal currency. It's very convenient because you can buy literally anything with it. And so we've all become complicit in that convenience. What we don't realize, the ease of using this money provides us, is the story, the reality behind every product that we buy. Where is it made? What are the conditions of the workers that made it? What are the conditions of the environment in which the resources were extracted to make it? How does all that work? It's hidden behind our use of money.
So what are some of the realities we face in addition to the ones you've already mentioned?
Well, I think it comes down to, you know, my friend Paul Anderson loves to refer to mind, body, and spirit as the three elements that make a person whole. And when I try to extract that to the community, it kind of comes out as, mind, body, spirit in the community, as we all gather together, would be more like discipline or economy, ecology, and community. So how we all relate to each other in a community is another version of that and is an expanded version of that. And I think that creating networks in the community of co-producing things really leads us to a new kind of culture that we've abandoned. Because everything we buy, everything we use in our everyday lives comes from the market, comes from somewhere we don't know, is produced some way we don't know. And we buy it using this money and bring it home and use it. And very few, very, very few of us actually produce anything useful to other people. We're usually just in a job somewhere. We handle information or we handle some part of a process and we're paid for it, and then we buy our products.
And we give away our power in the process.
And we give away our power in the process. Creating things in our own community gives us a tremendous amount of respect for each other, gives us a lot of enjoyment in the diversity of what people can create. And one thing that really popped out to me is that when you go back and think about groups of people finding, let's say, a new piece of land or whatever, they have to gather together as a social group, because not one person, even if they have 100 acres of land, no one person or one family can produce every single thing that they need. They can not do any of that well if they try to do all of it. But if they do a few things and they produce, you know, animals and fruit, perhaps, and vegetables, and then someone else, somewhere else in their community is producing grain and other things that we need, then we trade with each other. So no one produces everything. Everyone produces everything. And then you can trade. And that's how cultures got started.
You're listening to KDNK. This is Shifting Gears and a conversation with Michael Thompson about the people's economy. One of the things you you have a section in here that I'm looking at is around the question of how do we, the people, reclaim our power?
Right. The I think that when a community can decide they're going to adopt, like the communities in Maine have done, regulatory structure around food production and being able to sell food to people was so burdensome, created by large industries, and really had the effect of making it impossible for small producers to compete with them. The local farmers in Maine said, hey, we want to be able to sell food for money to our local community members, and we will follow very good local small business guidelines for food safety. And so the town of Sedgwick, Maine was the first one to adopt this. About several dozen other towns followed suit pretty quickly. And eventually the state of Maine, the legislature of the state of Maine adopted, actually wrote a law allowing this in the state. So a lot of people have jumped on it and said, this is great. They can trade. They use dollars. Some towns have their own currency in Maine, and they use that as well. And they buy and sell things from each other. So someone's raising sheep, they actually can slaughter the sheep and package it and freeze it and sell it to their neighbors.
So rather than resisting new regulations from the FDA, the communities of Maine decided to do their own local exchange that caught on locally to the extent that it became a state law.
Right.
And they weren't protesting. They weren't resisting. They were running forward with what worked for them.
Right. Exactly. As it says in the Declaration of Independence, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And when government makes it impossible to have those things, the people have the right to step up and create an alternative or to adjust the government to suit their needs. And I think that's what the people in Maine are doing. And I think the crux of it is that a community has to be responsible. So we as members of the community, we need to be responsible for creating quality. So if we are growing and harvesting vegetables or grain or meat or eggs or making cheese or whatever, we have to take on, we are responsible for the quality of those products because we want to give them, trade them, sell them to members of our community. And that's the one of the things that I love so much about the gift economy. The market economy drives everything to the lowest cost across the board, whereas the gift economy, which we could talk about a little further, the gift economy gravitates toward the highest quality, because when you give somebody something that they're going to consume and share with their family or friends, you want it to be the best it can possibly be, because they're going to give you something back in return, and they're going to want that to be the best quality they can make.
I think it's important to realize that the quality with which these people worked went all the way from the local food they grew and exchanged and sold to this Maine Food Sovereignty Act they manifested in the state legislature.
Mm-hmm.
And the role with which they benefited from the training from the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund and the democracy schools so that they knew the founding principles, the Declaration of Independence, and how to work with the system
mm-hmm.
rather than change the system or deviate it, but how to step into their power with the authority, as you say, to lay the foundation for a new government in such a form as most likely to affect their safety and happiness.
Right.
And some of the FDA statements about our power to choose our food
mm-hmm.
Are frightening and laughable.
Right. I think when we take that power into our own hands, which we don't need anyone's permission to do, we're already doing it. You and I were doing it. We're, you know, I've got lots of friends who make things and hunt things, and I trade with them in what we call the gift economy, and it works really well. And I think that it's a way for us to take responsibility for our own local economy. Because when the global economy falters, or worse, like it did in 2008, local communities are badly affected, some more than others, and without an alternative. If we have a local economy where a lot of things are produced, people can trade among themselves for, then we have resilience. And that's what I think all communities would love to have.
Well, I need to tell you about my conversation with Amory.
Okay.
When I asked him to define resilience, he said, when you see change as your friend, you can learn from it.
Mm-hmm.
And there's so much power in our becoming friends with each other through gifts and sharing our best
mm-hmm.
that's the glue that holds a community together and fuels the creativity and the responsibility that goes with the gifts, because part of the gift economy is the source water that we are all given.
Right.
And there's a high level of responsibility when you're upstream, and there's a high level of expecting accountability when you're downstream and you get something you're unwelcoming.
Right.
Something you're receiving that is not to the well-being of your family and your crops mm-hmm. and your animals.
Right. I think every community, especially as we see it out here in the mountains of Colorado, every community should take upon itself the responsibility to send no pollution downstream. And they should take upon themselves, claim upon themselves, the right to not tolerate any pollution from upstream. And I think when everyone adopts that philosophy, then we have all of a sudden cleaner watersheds, food sheds, and better agriculture.
Well, and cleaner communication, too, because mm-hmm. there's nothing more nourishing than the truth.
Very true.
One of the other topics that you highlight here is really already addressed to some degree in our earlier conversation, but you talk about quality as essential to a sovereign and sustainable local economy.
Yes. That's part of the responsibility aspect.
And can lead into a quality currency that makes those exchanges feasible.
Right. It's a sort of an honor ethic. And I think it's important to note that in the United States, we have Declaration of Independence, and we have the Constitution. And in the Constitution, a number of amendments are called the Bill of Rights. But in our Constitution, we don't have anything called the Bill of Responsibilities. And I think it's hard to imagine having rights without responsibilities. The two go together like the two sides of a coin. And I think if a community is to adopt a sort of independence as a local economy, not complete independence, just have another economy that they can rely on. So we have two economies going on, national and local. And for a community to adopt that local economy and claim and write a constitution of rights and responsibilities, that's essential because it's a balance and it allows us to hand down to the future a set of guidelines for future communities to follow, which I think could be very, very helpful.
The Swiss and the Japanese have long histories of alternative currencies, and the experience that it helps stabilize economies through difficult times, challenges, and collapses, and would certainly benefit us if we had another 2008 come around the corner here.
Yes, indeed. Some of the communities that get really badly affected by that are in sort of they sort of go into a sort of a panic and prices collapse, especially around real estate. When, let's say, a big corporation or a GM automobile plant leaves a community, they're suddenly in shock and prices of real estate collapse. People's mortgages are underwater and they can't leave and they're stuck. And they have no backup plan unless it's maybe work at Walmart or McDonald's or some of these other sort of global industry franchises that we have in every community. And that really makes a community fall apart. If the community had a robust local economy and there was a lot of production and consumption going on from local sources and a company left town, it left a lot of people without jobs.
That local economy can be really built on food.
Can be built on primarily food, and other things can come in after that.
So that provides stability and resilience.
Yes.
And the friendship of being well fed by your neighbors.
Yeah. And if in the near future Wall Street manages to collapse our global economy again, it would be nice to be all sitting around going, wow, did you read the news today? Can you see what happened? Wow, well, that's really terrible. Well, what's for dinner? Well, I've got this and I've got that. So if it doesn't matter, then, and I think that's the most important thing, is local economies can create themselves to reduce the impacts of these global effects.
And from what I can learn about Maine, they're running pretty strong.
They are.
There's a saying, as Maine goes, so goes the states.
Right. And as Jerome Osentowski likes to say, there's a billboard when you enter the state of Maine that says, the way it ought to be. And I think that's very true in many ways. I visited Maine when I was growing up in New England quite a bit, and I love that state. It's a beautiful place. And another thing that I think the communities in Maine and all over the country, all over the world, in fact, are learning is this whole other aspect of the sharing economy. There are, you know, we had Stephanie Sison started a seed library in Basalt. And so in our Basalt library, we have seeds. I just gave them a bunch of seed that I've harvested out of my garden this year from plants that I've been growing and reseeding, replanting for years. And they're really insect resistant without any chemical additives. They just evolved that way because I replanted them. And so you can go in the spring and get my lettuce seed and my arugula seed, and it's really robust. It's very well acclimated to this climate. So there's also communities that have in their libraries tool libraries. Imagine that. You give all your tools to the library, and then whenever you need them, you go borrow them. And you can borrow somebody else's tools that are in the library for free loan. And then so that's another thing. Everything you do like that negates the use of money. It just says, okay, you don't need the money to rent that, you can go to the library and get it. You don't need to spend money on seeds. You can get even better seed free at the library. And we would like it if you raised it and then harvested the seed and brought some back too. Then we get this cycle going, which supports everyone in the community.
And the renewal we all need.
Exactly.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you, Will. It was a pleasure.
You've been listening to Shifting Gears and a conversation with Michael Thompson about his vision for the people's economy in 2019. The People's Economy gatherings and conversations are scheduled for Tuesday, March 12th, Monday, April 1st, and Thursday, April 18th at the Basalt Public Library Community Room from 5 to 7 p.m. See you there.